Welcome. Thank you all for coming, and welcome to Marlborough College's Monday night lecture series entitled Secular and Sacred. Tonight's lecture speaker is Dr. Stephanie Kaza, and she will present the final lecture in the series for the fall semester. We'll continue this lecture series in the spring with a variety of lectures, a panel of religious leaders, and presentation of a film. So we hope that you're able to come to those as well. Before introducing Stephanie to you, I'd like to acknowledge our generous supporters in this series, the Littower Foundation, the Thompson Trust, the Vermont Humanities Council, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and an anonymous donor. And tonight, I'd like to tell you a little bit about Stephanie before she comes up. Stephanie is a professor of environmental studies at the Rubenstein School of Environment and Natural Resources of the University of Vermont. And when I was looking at potential speakers for this series, I very much wanted somebody who was engaged in the environment, in ecology, to come and speak. And so I thought, well, what am I going to do? I don't actually know anybody like that. So I typed into Google. I do that too. And I typed in religion and ecology. And I would say that of all the literally tens of thousands of returns I got on that, I found the information that was presented on Stephanie Kaza to be the very most interesting, and I'm not kidding. And then I found out that she was at the University of Vermont, and I was doubly thrilled. And so when I called her and had a conversation with her, I was very excited that she was both interested in our series and willing to come to the college. So that worked out very well. Stephanie's educational background includes undergraduate degrees in biology from Oberlin College, an MA in education from Stanford University, a PhD in biology from the University of California at Santa Cruz, and a Master's of Divinity from the Star King School of Ministry. And this breadth of her training is reflected in the range of courses that she teaches now and has taught in the past, including an Introduction to Environmental Studies, Religion and Ecology, Environmental Justice, Ecofeminism, and Radical Environmentalism. She is currently the president of the Society for Buddhist Christian Studies and is an active member of the Religion and Ecology Group of the American Academy of Religion. Stephanie has written extensively on topics of religion and the environment. Her work has been published in such journals as Ecotheology, the Journal of Buddhist Christian Studies, and the Canadian Journal of Environmental Education. She has authored or edited several books, including her latest which is an edited collection on Buddhism and consumerism entitled Hooked, Buddhist Writings on Greed, Desire, and the Urge to Consume. And she has a few copies with her if you're interested. In addition to her teaching and research, Stephanie is actively engaged in campus sustainability initiatives. She is co-chair of the UVM Environmental Council. Please welcome Stephanie Kaza for her talk on Ecology of Desire, Buddhist Views on Consumerism.
Well, thank you, Jennifer, for such a warm welcome, and also thank you to the students who and faculty that shared dinner with me. I think you have a wonderful community here of bright minds, and it's a thrill to visit. And this is my first visit to Marlboro and to southern Vermont as part of it. So, you know, when you live up in the north, it's a whole different place up there, the west coast of New England, Burlington. That's what my brother calls it. So let me start by just saying it's very interesting that the date I ended up with here is the night before the election. So this I can't get this off my mind, so I might as well just offer that as a disclaimer to begin with. So any of you who are following, you know, the standard media or the alternate media or your own heart or the corporate scandals, pick your train of thought. There's a lot riding on tomorrow's election. And it's equally bookended on the other side by Saturday. Some of you, I think, may have heard about Bill McKibben's International Day for Climate Change Action. And he came and spoke in my introductory class, which would be a complete anathema to this community. There are 200 people in that class. So it's a community all of its own. And so we did our own little climate action and stood by the UVM hedges. If you drive into town at UVM, they're spelled out these big letters. And held signs to the cars, you know, vote to save the climate. Of course, I thought, I don't know what that really means, but at least somebody's saying it. So I'm feeling very political tonight. And it's a good thing I have a little Buddhist grounding to keep me from getting too worried about all this. But I want to raise issues with you in that context tonight, and I hope you'll ask some good questions about it. I will be talking about consumerism and talking about it from a Buddhist perspective, but this is really a wonderful secular sacred conversation with, it's kind of seamless, really. But I want you to think about it in the context of global consumerism, global consumption, because it's not only Americans watching this election. It's many countries around the world wondering, what now will we get from America? And what now, what products, what trade, what policies, what wars, what leadership? So each of our elections has a tremendous footprint on the whole world. And you could say a tremendous ecological footprint, for that matter. So we'll keep that as a kind of a theme of why bother to think about this. And as Bill said, just to steal a line from him, he said, you know, one of the lead scientists, James Hansen, talking about climate change, said, you know, really, my data shows that it's getting worse faster than I thought. So we probably have about 10 years to really try to turn the carbon emissions graph down. And so Bill translated that into 4 election cycles, or 5, you could say, altogether. But we're at one right now. When you do that, it seems like each election becomes very, very important. But I'm sure you know that already. So that's my disclaimer. And if I veer towards the political, you'll know why, because I can't not think about it right now. In fact, I had to figure out when I was going to vote because I was coming down here overnight, and it wouldn't be at 7 o'clock in the morning tomorrow. All right, so why should we focus on consumerism? And we're going to start by trying to look at it a little analytically and get some facts and figures and a kind of scope of it. So you've got a ground to start from, and then I'm going to shed take a Buddhist lens, which is not the usual way people look at consumerism, but I think it's very helpful, very interesting, and it kind of opens it up. So who's consuming? Well, our population, world population's now at 6.1 billion. That's a lot of people. And by 2050 is expected to go to 8.9 billion. All those people will be buying things, needing things, wanting things, needing fresh water, and so on. But what is crucial is that as the population grows, there's more and more of a middle class with middle class desires. So right now, surprisingly, it used to be when we talked about consumerism, we talked about the Western countries and we, you know, Eastern European Union and the United States and Japan, Australia. But now 20% of the global consumer class is in China and India. And there's a consumer class also, of course, in all the other developing nations, sort of a first world elite that lives within those countries, spending money and having things and developing their houses at the same rate as the richest Americans or the richest in the rest of the world. So this consumer class in India and China actually, in sheer numbers, is bigger than all of the consumers in Western Europe right now. So the picture is changing very quickly. By 2015, it's expected that there will be 2 billion people in this consumer class, the high consumers. And of course, energy use is increasing rapidly. We're going to look a little bit at China and India tonight because you can't not look at them now. And just alone thinking about all the coal that's being produced in China right now for their incredible economy that's just really taking off. So when you say consumerism, you could think about, well, my own personal choices at the grocery store, but I want to think about it in the biggest sense, consuming energy, consuming carbon, consuming all that we actually take from the planet to sustain human life. So we could spend quite a bit of time on our climate concerns, and I do want to tell you this is one of the most active parts of the campus sustainability movement, just as an aside. I went to the American Association for Sustainability in Higher Education conference in Phoenix, and the students there were on fire. It was fantastic. They were practically chanting carbon neutral, you know, every time you turned around another corner. And in California alone, every campus now of the University of California system and the California State University system has a student sustainability coordinator. And they are networking like crazy. This is only a year or two old, and they're all challenging the energy policies on every campus. So it's very exciting. Yale has just introduced a brand new program heading their pledge to carbon neutrality at the Yale School of Environment and Environmental Studies and Forestry. And the whole campus has a plan for turning their carbon emissions down. Gus Speth is very serious about it, and the president has pledged this. So, of course, I'm all ready to pressure our president at UVM to take the consumer challenge seriously and meet this climate concern. But, of course, there are other reasons to study this topic besides climate. And since the title of this series is Sacred and Secular, we couldn't not speak about how the market has become a world religion. David Loy, a religious philosopher, speaks about this and talks about how it has undermined traditional religions. And the two unshakable statements of faith in this world market religion are, one, that growth and enhanced world trade will benefit everyone, so let's just have more and more of it, and that the growth will not be constrained by any limits of a finite planet. Well, somehow it all just keep working, just keep on having things and making more things. Well, from a religious perspective, the power of this worldview lies in its extremely effective conversion techniques. It's so seductive. You become converted instantly. The appeal of product after product captures the masses and replaces all the other approaches to meaning and satisfaction. In fact, Loy points out that this one of the significant flaws of this market religion is that it depletes moral capital. And I like that phrase. Some of you may have heard the phrases natural capital and social capital and built capital. But moral capital is really about how the market requires character traits like trust, so it will be efficient. You need to trust your car maker or your food maker, so on. But it also erodes personal responsibility for other people. It's just a market relationship. So you have to confront the impact of consumerism is confronting this moral deterioration. What's happening to our stock in moral capital? Of course, in Vermont, we think we have a larger stock of that than elsewhere, but another concern of mine that I teach about in some of my courses is about consumer identity crowding out or displacing ecological identity. Mitch Thomas Show, who some of you know over here at, he's actually just left Antioch, but he wrote a wonderful book on ecological identity. And that's made up of our sense of place, our ecological concerns, our environmental values, such as reverence for life or compassion, and the environmental role models we've learned from. All that's our ecological identity. And they influence, of course, how we relate to the earth and what choices we'll make environmentally. But consumer identity, in contrast, is based on brand name preferences, on our material possessions, on our class status, our social group, our market desires. And if you spend all your time in the supermarket, I know some of you probably had this experience, paralyzed in front of the salsas, like, well, I don't know, should it be a locally grown one, or should it have organic ingredients, or do I want a really hot one, or just a mild one, or you could stay there a long time. And it's difficult, that kind of exhaustive decision-making, I think, has replaced the kind of decision-making we need to do around really difficult environmental choices. We just get tired on all this consumer choice stuff. But I think actually the greatest motivator for studying consumption and consumerism may in the end be self-preservation. That all the signs just point to increasing difficulty in sustaining ecological life support systems. There's evidence everywhere, and all of the human population dependent on them. So I don't need to enumerate this part to you of pollution and depletion of resources. It just continues to worsen, and I don't want this to be a terrible bummer lecture, so I won't go into that in great depth. I'll assume you can read it and have studied it already to some extent. But obviously, as rates of consumption increase in developing countries and their interest in moving right up to the scale of the first world or the developed or whatever current name you want to call those of us who spend a lot of money on things, it gets to be the numbers only increase. So even though population levels have tended to be heading more towards stability than when, say, the population bomb came out in the 1960s, consumption is not anywhere close to stabilizing. So let's think about how we could characterize the world in terms of consumers. In 1991, a UN Human Development Program wrote a report dividing world economic activity into five income sectors. So I'll just give you this picture here because it's been referred to so often. It's just the sort of thing you want to be able to know about. This is called the champagne glass figure. And in the very top part of it is the top or richest fifth that would account for, at least at that time, 85% of global income, trade, exchange, savings. And then you see it drops very dramatically. But there's little lines across dividing the fifths up. So the members of the top fifth are this group we've been talking about, where comfort and choice are regular privileges. And then the next fifth are countries, say, like Brazil, Costa Rica, much of Eastern Europe, East Asian nations like Thailand and Malaysia, that are approaching consumption levels, and probably it'd be a little fatter champagne glass by now. And the bottom three-fifths may contribute a lot to global population, but relatively little to the global economy and to consumption. Now, it's handy to look at this in terms of three classes. It changes the word consumer a little, but just to spread out who's responsible for what. So this is a little bit of the analysis here. If you just look down the left-hand side, you can see how do the diets vary from the top consumer class, the ones that are blacked in there at the top of the champagne glass, compared to the middle three lines. At this time, it was 3.3 billion, and the poor, the ones who are so impoverished that their impact on the environment is just in trying to get fuel or a little bit of grain or a little bit of water out of the ground. So look at the variation in diet. We have tremendous amount of packaged food, endless amount of meat, all kinds of bottled beverages, very high production value in most of our foods. Whereas the middle three groups are, you know, their diet is based around just the adequacy of good water and simple grains, and the poor have insufficient of both. You can do the same thing with transportation, with materials and lodging. Just the lodging alone, we're used to climate-controlled buildings. If a building is a little cold, you go, well, what's the matter? Didn't someone turn the heat on? I mean, that's an automatic response. Or if it's a little too hot, well, doesn't this building have air conditioning? That is what we're used to in this country. Whereas other countries, electricity comes and goes, and maybe there isn't any at all. So I'm sure the income figures are out of date at this point, but this gives you a kind of view that not everybody is equally responsible for a consumer footprint. So it's really the top and the bottom groups creating the greatest footprint, and by far the top. The top for its extravagant use of resources, our luxury foods, expensive cars, etc., throwaway materials, and the bottom for a sort of desperate poverty. But if you compare those three different classes, The consumer class, which we'll call that top class, is responsible for most of the environmental impacts on the planet. So just to back to climate change again, I told you it was on my mind. The poor release 0.1 ton of carbon dioxide emissions per person per year. Not very much. The middle income group, 0.5 tons, and the consumer class, 3.5. So an enormous gap, just like the wealth gap. And you probably know this figure, that Americans comprise only 5% of the Earth's people, yet they produce 25% of the greenhouse gas emissions. So again, a large footprint there. The consumer class responsible for 90% of all chlorofluorocarbons destroying the ozone layer, 96% of the world's radioactive waste. And of course, the most number of cars, which is just going to continue to double. It was, try to imagine, 1950, 50 million cars. Up to 500 million in 1990, projected to double again by 2015. So now that's a kind of overview, but the picture is changing dramatically, as I said, as more and more of the world joins the consumer class. So of the estimated 1.7 billion members right now, the consumer class, quite a few, nearly half are in the developing world. And China, for example, has added 11,000 more cars to its streets every day in 2003. So a picture, many, many lots of cars, and each day 11,000 more in China. In India, film and electronics are growing rapidly so that everybody can have their iPods and their cell phones and their, I guess, their Blackberries. I'm not sure what else is important over there. And if the calculations show if the average Chinese consumer increased their energy budget to American levels, China would need 90 million barrels of oil each day, which currently is 11 million more than are even produced every day for all of the world's consumers. So obviously that's not going to work. So right now, China at 1.297 billion people and India at 1.08 billion is really the place to look. And I just want to commend to you a couple of books I drew on heavily for this lecture, and I use the State of the World 2004 for my class Unlearning Consumerism, which is where we look right at this in great depth. But the 2006 State of the World has a whole chapter on India and China and their impact as their economies grow. So right now in 2005, China uses 26% of the world's crude steel, 32% of the world's rice, 37% of the world's cotton, and 47% of the world's cement. They are the leading consumers. And in their number of cars produced has gone from in 1995 from 300,000 in 2005, 10 years later, to 2.6 million. Actually, you know, bicycles have been outlawed on the streets of Beijing. It used to be that that's how you got around in Beijing, but now the cars have their way. Cell phones, there were 350 million subscribers to cell phones in China there were 7 million in 1996, and now there are 350 million. Twice as many cell phone users as in the United States. Starting to get the picture here. Now, China, because they're leaping forward so fast, is able to take up some new technologies very quickly, and they now have pledged to do solar hot water for 35 million buildings in China. That's 10% of the hot water of China will be heated by solar electricity. We're nowhere close to that in this country. That's out of their brand new energy law. And India is the fourth largest wind power industry in the planet now, with a goal of 20 to 25% of renewable energy. But let's look at their use of fuels. So these are a couple charts out of this State of the World 2006. And just you want to just kind of look at them in comparison with the three countries from the West, Germany, Japan, and United States. And you can see how much, just at the top, to see how much coal China is using, 957 million tons of the equivalent of oil. It's like almost twice as much as the U.S. is using, whereas the U.S. is using still quite a bit of oil. But per person, it's going up, but even there, comparing China and India to the U.S. So there's sort of two ends of the culprits here, in a sense. Obviously, the U.S. is the greatest consumer of energy, but very quickly, China and India, as they build their economies, are aiming to enter. So probably the most useful number on all these columns is the lower right. The percent change over time from 1990 to 2004 in carbon emissions. And carbon emissions is a pretty good standard to look at in terms of whatever fuel you're burning, what are you putting into the air, and what's your sort of carbon economy. And the U.S.'s has gone up by 19%, but China's has gone up by 67% and India by 88%. So there, it's a very rapid rate of increase and only going to keep going in that direction, just soaring upwards. So if we think about the ecological footprint of all of this, and this literally, I want to explain this concept in case you're not familiar with it, because it's very handy in terms of thinking about the footprints of countries or states or regions. You can do this analysis at any level. But it's literally the impact of your need for your land-based area to grow food, to produce energy, to store waste, to get the water you need, to produce shelter, and so on. So this is a kind of cartoon version of it, but it gets the point, and you can very quickly imagine who has one of the largest ecological footprints in the world. It's the United States. But we'll compare it here. Here's a little sample, so you can just get a picture. The original footprint analysis was done for by scientists at the University of British Columbia, who, by the way, this concept has made such an impact there in Vancouver and at UBC that they received the sustainability award at that AG conference. They've got, I think, 8 people in their Office of Sustainability and have done some fantastic things. And if you're interested in this field, look up UBC's sustainability report. So there's the footprint for Vancouver. It takes up that big of a square amount of land down in the bottom, and you can see proportionally how much it would take to grow the food, to develop the wood, the forestry, and the energy block is huge. So that's how you would draw a footprint, and this is actually one of the exercises my students do in the introductory class. They try to map their own ecological footprint. So let's think about China and India's footprint in this big picture of consumption and how it adds to the whole global footprint. So China and India, their total footprint, if you calculated and mapped it out, is shown here in the upper column. And it's about, China is about equivalent to Europe right now and still under the United States. But again, look at the far column to the right, the growth in the footprint, 24% in China, 21% in the United States over 10 years. So that's a kind of bigger and bigger foot landing on the planet to sustain the lifestyle of the people in those countries. Proportionally, Japan's growth is relatively small, but you could map this for each of the different countries. But when you add it all up together, if you don't remember anything else out of these few charts, remember this graph. You need to maybe years down here. Okay. So at what point did we cross beyond the global biocapacity to support the consumer's lifestyles of all the people on the planet? It's a little before 1990. And our footprint is actually starting to require us to have other planets. Unfortunately, we don't really have other planets. Some calculations say if everyone lived like Americans, we would need 4 or 5 other planets to just provide our food, our energy, and our water. So I put all this out here for you to be sure we're starting in the biggest picture with the biggest level of concern, and that it isn't just a matter of which salsa to buy. All right, in 1997, switching gears here a little, the film Affluenza premiered to audiences around the United States, offering a diagnosis for what ails the planet. How many people saw that film, Affluenza? Oh, it's very funny. You really should take a shot at it, because it spoke to people at all levels, conservative, liberal, rich, poor, got a lot of high ratings. And the film's producer, John DeGraff, defined affluenza, there's a book by the title too, as this terrible disease threatening our wallets, our friendships, our families, our communities, our environment. And he defined it as a painful, contagious, socially transmitted condition of overload, debt, anxiety, and waste resulting from the dogged pursuit of more. So now let's take a look at our own society. We've looked a little bit at China and India because I didn't want to leave them off the map, but since America is 5% of the planet's population, consuming 25%, we we have to be honest here and take our full Buddhist scrutiny of what's before us. How is it possible, here's some figures for you, that Americans spend more for trash bags than 90 of the world's 200 countries spend for everything? Just our trash bags. Could it really be true that we have twice as many shopping malls as high schools? That we consume our average body weight, I think this is an old body weight that must average children into it, 120 pounds, every day. Each individual person consumes that in extracted and processed materials. So not just your food, but what it took to build the buildings you're in, to create the energy or your fuels for your automobile. And that humans altogether take 40% of the Earth's entire plant productivity just for themselves. We're a pretty dominant species here. Apparently, America's 102 million households currently contain and consume more stuff than all other households throughout history, all put together. That's a pretty big footprint. So those are just some sample figures to give you a sense of how strong, how big our impact is. But let's get an example, one little example, so we can get our handle around it. What does consumption really look like on the ground? How about our beloved coffee? Now, I won't make you raise your hands to say how many people are coffee drinkers here, but at least we can say we all know coffee drinkers, right? So, say the average person drinks 2 cups a day. Not the average college student, but the average person altogether. A year's worth of coffee would be about 18 pounds of beans per year, if you bought your little package of beans. Now, that would require you to have 12 personal coffee trees, okay? But not just 12 personal coffee trees, you would also need 11 pounds of fertilizer and pesticide. You could have your name on them, you know, a Starbucks sort of monogram. And in the processing, though, you personally, for your 2 cups of coffee a day, would release 43 pounds of coffee pulp into the rivers. Now, when that coffee pulp goes out through the processing, it consumes the life-supporting oxygen of the river as the pulp decomposes. And of course, so the beans come to the U.S. and are roasted using natural gas. And remember, then they're packed in those multi-layer super-duper bags, shipped by trucks, usually getting something like 6 miles to the gallon, regional warehouse, trying to get the whole picture here. Coffee's the second leading export crop in the world after oil and the second largest source of foreign income for developing nations. So I'm sure you know thousands of biologically rich tropical forests have been cleared to support the North American boom in espresso shops. It didn't just happen out of the blue. Well, let's think about the other items on your breakfast table. Maybe you might have orange juice from Brazil, or grapes from Chile, or apples from New Zealand. No, here you would only have Vermont apples. But maybe in an off-season. Cocoa from Malaysia or Africa, bananas, Costa Rica. And when they appear at the supermarket, all the shipping costs are virtually invisible. Production costs, you don't know. An average bite of American food, you have any idea how far it travels? 1,500 miles, the average bite of food. And globally, over 650 tons of food travel around the Earth each year, with global markets competing, you know, for our consumer dollars. Now, that's just our food. We could also talk about, of course, electronic waste, but I'll spare you some of that. I'm doing a course next semester on high-tech trash, because a couple of new books have come out, and it'll be very interesting. But e-waste alone is generating 70% of the heavy metals in United States landfills. So this is old computers, old cell phones, they're just piling up. And in fact, this is one of the toxic trades that we now ship around the world. And there's quite a strong dismantling process going on in China. There's one main city over there where that's what the entire business is. And there's an excellent video on this. It's actually horrifying, but you see people taking computers apart and melting them down and getting the little wires, trying to get a little bit of gold. And it's all out in the open, and the rivers are totally polluted. And our obsolete computers are their economy. So there's some ecological impacts. But then let's get right down to it, the psychic space. I knew I would do that sooner or later. Okay. The American way. I buy, therefore I am. So what kind of a toll has this taken on our capacities? Well, some people say the drive to consume has displaced the psychic space once filled by religion, family, community. We spend more time on personal lifestyle pleasures, so that's less time in civic engagement and public life. Callie Lassen, some of you will know, the author of Culture Jam, talks about micro jolts of commercial pollution that flood our brains. So I think any of you who have studied abroad and come back to America, you feel those micro jolts right away, right? It's like just shocking how many ads are coming at you, on whether it's on the computer screen or on the billboards or the train stations. Every day, in his book he says, every day an estimated 12 billion display ads, 3 million radio commercials, and more than 200,000 TV commercials are dumped into North America's collective unconscious. Now think about that. That's a pretty polluted consciousness. How do you think clearly when that much debris is being put into your mind? And furthermore, advertising such as this is deliberately fostering a climate of self-involvement that revolves around your own material desires and fostering greed and status envy and hyperstimulation and basically at root dissatisfaction. The advertisers want you to be so dissatisfied that you will keep looking for the product that will make you feel satisfied. And of course, children are especially vulnerable to this. And I should let you know that if this becomes a deeply entrenched habit, then, you know, searching for the products, you can become a shopaholic. Now, this is a real term, and it's actually listed in the great book. I forget the name of that cycle, that list of all the, that's it, of psychological disorders. It's right there now, shopaholism. So I wanted to show you a little bit of data from my class on shopaholism. I forced them to be honest. The second weekly assignment in that class is the property list. And you have to list everything you own. So, for example, here's two clothing lists from two students. And it's astonishing. Who needs three wigs? Or eight crop dresses? And I couldn't help myself. I was trying to be very Buddhist non-judgmental, but when I saw 55 pairs of shoes, I mean, that's like, you know, Ms. Philippines. So this is just clothing. They had to list everything at home as well as school. Now, maybe hardly any of you have anything approaching this, but try this one. Recreational gear, one person's list. This is one person's list. He's a skier, he or she, I can't remember, is a skier, obviously a very good skier, needs five pairs of skis, all different kinds of skiing, poles and boots and so on, and then backcountry stuff, mountain biking, surfboarding, sea kayaking, does everything, but personally owns all this equipment. So maybe there's somebody like that out in this audience, I don't know. Of course, college students are great consumers of electronics as well. In fact, dorm rooms really are not big enough anymore for all the electronics. So I started actually collecting this to give a paper on it because I was so interested in how many books and tapes and CDs. And the average number of CDs was really up there around a couple hundred. Now I think that's going down. Everybody's got iPods and it's all on their computers anyway, so why have all that material storage? But you still, if you're a musical person, you've got to have your equipment, your instruments, and everybody has their computers and their cameras and so on. So it's a tremendous amount of stuff. So what are we going to do about this? Is there a role for religion? So now, having been somewhat chastened by the reality of today's modern young consumers, here's my basic outline for the rest of this talk. So, is there a role for religion in responding to this state affair? So we've had some straight data here. And should religious leaders and institutions engage these moral questions of consumerism? There is a growing library out there on this. Certainly for some denominations, the environmental crisis has served as a wake-up call, inspiring study groups and greening projects. And some denominations raise issues of global inequity or the condition of the poor. You know, there's quite a campaign around debt forgiveness based on the Jubilee concept. There's also a fabulous campaign called What Would Jesus Drive? Which WWJD, you know, the little bracelet. It's just a kind of little transformation of that. And Bill McKibben was very involved in that too, signs in the church parking lots by the SUVs. Anyway, religions have historically played a very important role in raising fundamental questions about the quality and meaning of life. And over the last decade, this scholarly field, as well as movement, religion and ecology, has really grown tremendously, addressing environmental issues from a religious perspective. There's a brand new book out now from the World Watch Group by Gary Gardner, and I've been watching his work, and so I commend this to you. They just released in the last month or two. And he's been analyzing the role religion can play from an environmentalist perspective, and he lists five significant assets religion can bring to this dialogue. First, religions wield considerable moral authority. Moral capital is still basically pretty high in the religious denominations. There's been lots of scandals, but still, they've got kind of ownership on religious texts and rituals and communities. So moral authority, and of course they've got pulpits to speak from, and often in political arenas too. You know, when the evangelical Christians, for example, went to the White House and up on the Hill to talk to the congressional offices, they made a difference on the Endangered Species Act. They said, excuse me, those were God's creatures that act was designed to protect, and we would like you to please pay attention to that. And they were the most effective lobbyists. So then second, church religions have, generally as a body, a very large membership base, bigger than most other things. I mean, there's a lot of Muslims in the world. There's a lot of Christians. There's a lot of Buddhists and so on. So big membership base. And often extensive material resources, either in land or financial base, and that can be used to raise awareness. They're also very strong influence in shaping worldviews and have been, you know, for as long as we've been keeping track, and would be really supportive in questioning consumerist ideology. But perhaps the greatest asset of the is the religious capacity for building community and social capital. It's at the centerpiece of an effective religion, and there's good techniques around it. So, what the heck? Let's see what religions have to offer here. So I'll just briefly put up a few of this kind of standard critiques of consumerism before I give you some Buddhist insights, and we'll get to the Buddhist part here. So, so some of the traditional critiques I listed up there, the Puritan critique we all identify with here being in New England, it's the one about, you know, really any kind of consumer goods, if it's more than what you need, is a distraction from your spiritual development. And that would include, you know, dancing shoes to, you know, CDs, and even books might be a distraction. Actually, what I have the students do is make nominations out of their own belongings for each of these critiques. And some of the Puritan ones are things like, oh, all the posters all over my room, they're a real distraction from my spiritual practice. So that's the puritanical approach, you know, get that clothing down to the simple gray dress, don't smile too much, and just practice your religion. Stay, you know, pretty stern about that. So that would be the critique of a lot of stuff that's entertainment-based, right? So games, computer games, a lot of equipment, anything that's a lot of television, a lot of movies, all these things that are distractions. That would be the Puritan critique. All right, the Quaker critique, which we also probably know fairly well since Quakers are very strong in New England, is a very pragmatic one, very practical. Things should endure. And so the Quakers are particularly critical of disposable goods, things that just, you know, why is this car already, you know, 3 years, it's no good, or the computer, the turnover. A good Quaker good should last a long time, like a solid house, you know, a good pair of shoes, a homemade skirt, or something like that. So that's a Quaker critique. Now, the Republican critique, and this actually, that should be a small r, not a capital R, excuse me, so try not to put an actual political party on this, but this is more about civic life. And the Republican critique is that the more people improve their own individual lives, the bigger their houses, the more garages they have, the nicer their backyards, the more they turn inward to their own household, or in fact, literally, you can see that people orient their houses and their household life to the backyard, right? Their private backyard where the pool is, where the grill is, you know, the croquet or whatever. But they, in the old days, you know, the more civic life happened when the porches went to the street and people engaged with each other. So that there's a correlation between how much stuff you have and a reduction in civic engagement. And that a democracy or a good national economy and governance structure is much more supported by more engaged civic life. So it'd be better to have a small house with a porch facing the street if you wanted a strong, you know, Vermont, for example, than a lot of backyards facing away, isolating people. So that's Republican. Marxist, you could probably guess, is objections around sweatshop labor and the abuse of the masses to produce your goods, like all these countries like Bangladesh producing t-shirts, you know, for 5 cents an hour and then selling them at enormous prices. So a real abuse of people's labor. And the other Marxist critique is around consumerism being a kind of opiate for the masses. That's okay, work your 50 weeks out of the year, we know you only get 2 weeks vacation, and take those that horrible minimum wage because you'll be getting some money you can spend on the things you want. So don't question the system. It's that kind of opiate. So that's the Marxist critique. And the last, the aristocratic, I'm afraid I even fall prey to, but that's really the one that says anything that's not handmade is really kind of not worth having. All those things that are reproduced, you know, a million of them, all those little rubber duckies, who wants those? But if someone could throw a duck on a pottery wheel, why, that would be amazing. And I would want that pottery duck. So I must say, I was very impressed when I got Paul Hawken to write the introduction to my book, Hooked, down here. He has a friend who owns only 600 objects total in his house. And he's a pledge to keep it at that. So if somebody gives him something, then he has to get rid of another thing. So his house has become like more and more precious objects like this because he keeps refining it upwards. It's probably like an altar of some kind. Imagine, only 600. So anyway, the Buddhist critiques. Let's get to that Buddhism. So is there a role for Buddhism to play, particularly given that there's not really that many Buddhists in this country and we don't really read a lot or hear too much from Buddhists from other countries other than a few ambassadors like the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh. But generally, you don't spend a lot of time talking to Thai or Vietnamese Buddhists or people from India if you're in America. I mean, we probably should, but we tend not to. So the Buddhist initiative's actually been pretty modest, and that's why I can cover all of them pretty quickly in this lecture. There's a few books you might have heard of, like Small is Beautiful by E.F. Schumacher, did publicize Buddhist ideas in an economic sense. And of course, a lot of Gary Snyder's work was very much around a Buddhist philosophy, more oriented towards wilderness and environment protection. A few Western Buddhist teachers have taken up some themes related to consumption. Philip Kaplow, who was the Zen teacher at Rochester Zen Center, one of the earliest ones here, who wrote The Three Pillars of Zen. He wrote a lot on vegetarianism, and that center is a very committed vegetarian center. Robert Aiken, who was a teacher in Hawaii at Honolulu, a lot about reducing wants and needs. He was an old Vortex resistor and really got it down to the basics. Thich Nhat Hanh, I think one of the most radical things he's preached about, he's expanded the fifth precept, and the precepts are kind of, you could say, like commandments, but the fifth precept is no abuse of delusion-producing substances. It's supposed to be, you know, not using alcohol. So, or drugs. So for monks, if you take a vow with these precepts, you stop drinking any kind of wine or alcohol or using drugs. But Thich Nhat Hanh has expanded that to include other delusion-producing substances like junk television shows, advertising, magazines, pornography, even candy, you know, kind of the sugar addiction. So he's really asking us to look at what makes your mind deluded. And if it does, then that's some kind of consumption you might want to look at. Okay, so since there's not a lot written, I'll tell you what at least I've come up with. And I actually kind of commissioned this book on consumption because I wanted to see what other writers would say. So I got people from many different Buddhist traditions, Tibetan lineage, Vipassana practitioners, Zen people, and some of the Pure Land folks to pick some principle in Buddhist philosophy or practice and see what it could tell us about consumerism. But let's just see at least the three primary critiques at root that are fairly easy to grasp from any lineage, and it'll explain a little bit about Buddhism at the same time, are the ones I'll tell you about. So first, that the critique that consumerism reinforces the self or our ego identity. Now, in Buddhism, identity formation or ego-based views of self promote ignorance. They're based on attachment to false views of self. This is a basic Buddhist tenet that if you, our usual idea of self is seen as a significant delusion. You know, when you identify with, I'm a professor, or I'm a woman, or I'm an AARP member. Oh, I don't know how many people identify with that. But but however you identify with yourself, who you specifically think you are, from a Buddhist perspective, you're off the mark. Because the fundamental Buddhist law is a law of interdependence, and whatever you happen to be at the moment is a combination of all the causes that are working on you right in the present moment and also historically. So that means the weather, what somebody said to you today, how you're thinking about your family, which friends you bumped into, what you ate for breakfast, and then, by the way, what your mother had you eat for breakfast for 10 years before you got to college. Well, that's also influenced you, and what her mother had her eat for breakfast, and what country her mother's mother grew up in, etc. So obviously it's an infinitely long list of causes, multi-causal self. So if you think that you are in charge of who that self is, that's a pretty big delusion, much as the marketers might have you think otherwise. So advertising aggressively promotes this kind of self-involvement and wants you, your self-identity to depend on what brands you're associated with. And of course, little kids can name off all these brands and they'll tell you what they want when they go to the grocery. And some of the most uncomfortable moments probably for all of us are being in a store where some little kid is whining for the brand they have to have. And the parent is just, well, how do I handle this? This wasn't in my training, you know, kind of defenses against brand names. But actually, from a Buddhist perspective, consumerism can have a pretty negative effect on self-identity, preventing the mind from engaging in more positive, life-affirming activity. People that are the most hooked on consumer identities tend to be the most insecure about feeling grounded in this much larger interdependent world. So, from a Buddhist perspective, the ego-based views promote ignorance and suffering. And suffering is the kind of core lens through which a Buddhist will see the world. It's like all beings that exist have a life that's marked by suffering because it's full of impermanence. It never stays the same. Whatever you thought you were today or whatever your health was, it will change. And we get very attached to these states of mind as they come along, especially the pleasurable ones. But in fact, we should be more identifying with that dynamic, impermanent sense of flux and flow. That's the more accurate view of self from a Buddhist perspective. So if we relate to material objects as real and permanent, that even further reinforces ourselves as permanent. Like our houses, for example. If you think your house is permanent, of course, all you really need to do is own a house in cold weather and you realize how impermanent it is. How difficult it is to maintain a house. But whatever your car, whatever you're identifying with, you, at least on a temporary basis, think, well, I can count on it, you know, my car runs. So we get attached just out of habit to these kind of more fixed views of the world. Or you could go to the other extreme. The other mistaken extreme is thinking that nothing is real or permanent, the sort of why bother approach. So if nothing matters, then let's go down and have a drink. So with that logic, you can successfully avoid engaging in the world at all. So both of those are seen as delusions, both extremes, either the strongly material view of the self or the strongly relative view. Okay, so that's the first Buddhist critique, that anything that's going to really make it harder for us to break through this delusion of self is a problem. The second one, it goes back to the earliest Buddhist ethical tenet of non-harming. So the second critique is that consumerism promotes, rationalizes, and condones harming. And that's the foundational principle here, the first of the five precepts, not to kill. And obviously monks are taught that, and non-killing, it's transferred from Hinduism into Buddhism, but consumer goods don't intentionally harm, but you track any one of the ecological footprints of the goods, and there's a lot of harm behind it, whether it's water pollution or clear-cut forests, etc. So that one I think is fairly straightforward in terms of producing suffering, because you can literally map the suffering, you could analyze it. I have long had a fantasy that our environmental impact statements would have the last section would be an ethical section, and it would list literally the suffering, the karmic consequences of the choice to give someone a permit, not just the ecological consequences. But I think perhaps the strongest Buddhist critique is this one that it promotes desire and dissatisfaction. And if there's one thing Buddhism has a lot to say about, it's desire. It's really a wonderful religion for trying to understand desire. All those meditation techniques, koans, all that stuff is to bust through and study your own desires, because desire makes you so unhappy. Whatever it is you want or don't want. So something you're going towards or something you feel aversion from. And marketers play right to that, right and left. They either want you to crave the object, or they want you to crave something that will relieve, like problems with insects or bad body odor, something like that. So they'll take advantage of all that. All right, so I want to be able to get to some questions here, so I better tell you at least how does Buddhism deal with those three critiques? What does it actually offer? So this is what I'm calling methods for liberation, because the Buddhist philosophical or religious project, you could say, is the liberation of the self from this paralyzing delusion, and to free the self to be more fully and present in an interdependent world, and to be able to serve others seen as just a mirror of the self. So the first one, the identity problem around self and ego, just merely exposing that process does a lot of good. And you can do this in a meditation context, or you can do it in some kind of group support context, or just looking yourself at, walk around your house, see which items would you take out in case of a fire, or which ones would you be the most attached to. You can study your own clinging. How do you announce yourself? I am a vegetarian, and I eat like this, and you must serve me this food. Or, what are the ways you do self-identify? So you can start to see the hooks at every turn. This is why I think consumerism is a fabulous field for religious practice. I mean, it's so thick, it's everywhere. So just walking down the store aisles, well, I like that color. No, that color wouldn't look good on me. Or which teas? Well, right now I'm into green tea. Yes, I like green tea. So every time you see that word I come up in your own mind, it's a practice in liberation, because you can catch it. You can almost have a quick moment of awareness of, oh, there it is again. Oh, I'm reinforcing that self-identity. Oh, I want to buy another teapot. Oh, yeah, really, I'm into tea, So the opposite of it is cultivating a kind of relational worldview. Instead of having the focus always on creating the I, you turn it around to, well, how could I turn this tea obsession, I'm obviously speaking personally, to my husband and I both, we love tea and we love tea tasting. We've got an incredible shop, Dobra Tea in Burlington, that only supplies us. But then how can we turn it to a relational event? How can you invite people to tea? How can you share with it? How can you be building relationships so then you're freeing yourself from the tyranny of the objects itself? So that's a kind of liberatory method. Obviously, with non-harming, just simply asking the question about how much harm is an object has caused is a very simple practice. And we don't have all the information based on this, but more and more there are good books out there that will tell you. In fact, I use one in my class called Stuff, and it's 10 chapters. It's a little tiny book, and one's on hamburgers, one's on computers, one's on bicycles, and one's on cotton t-shirt, and you just follow the story of how did that thing get to be made, and you learn about how much suffering there is. So over time, I think you could come to see, I'm going to make this choice because it causes less suffering. I actually think this is at the heart of the local foods movement, in a sense, because instead of buying food that's been shipped 1,500 miles and you've drawn on a lot of energy and a lot of outsourced labor, you can get to know your local farmer, you're creating positive relations, and you're reducing the amount of suffering in your local purchases. So there's many avenues, obviously, to that. Choice of food is an easy one, around animal foods and so on. Probably the last one is the hardest, breaking the links of desire. So I'll just give you a little wee taste of some sophisticated Buddhist philosophy to take home. Whoops.
thought at that time. My attachment. So this is a little map of a classic early Buddhist teaching, the links of dependent, codependent origination, a kind of wheel of becoming. And when I started thinking about how do you stop this cycle of desire, which in the Four Noble Truths is what's promoting so much suffering, what is the way out? Well, this was the Buddhist prescription. First, understanding how these links work and understanding every one of the concepts. So we could start at any point, but just to kind of walk you through quickly, let's start at craving over here on the left, because that's what you can kind of relate to when you want something. You want some new shoes, or you want just your favorite kind of super dark chocolate. So whichever thing you want to name, the craving for it leads you to grasp for it, and you go towards it. And if we walk backwards, where did that craving come from for a minute? It came from certain feeling states, emotional states of wanting. I don't have enough, or I need more, or I'm really happy, and so today's a really great day for chocolate. But those feeling states are very ephemeral. But what do they come from? They come from contact with those products or with maybe some kind of smell, but a sensory contact. So the sense fields have been stimulated, and the sense fields make you want to contact the object, and that generates its feelings. So pretty soon you're wanting through the feelings, and you develop this craving, the grasping. Now, let's see, where should we go? Let me keep going backwards here from the sense fields. Sometimes what actually is stimulated are, let me explain the Buddhist view of how our sense organs work, because it's very interesting. It's not just simply like, say you take your eye, it's not only the eye organ, the literal thing you can dissect and take out and study like in physiology, but it's the eye consciousness that's in your brain is considered part of perception, and the object itself. So it takes all three, the object, the consciousness, and the organ, to have perception happen. So from a Buddhist perspective, it's equally, if not even more important, how has that consciousness already been shaped so that when you see an object, you are either going towards it or away from it or a person. So studying the consciousness becomes a very important part of understanding desire. So this part here, name and form, is what's been conditioned by previous experiences that mold consciousness. And if you take consciousness in its sort of broadest scope, It makes karmic formations, or it represents karmic formations, I should say, which would be long-term patterns. And you might be able to understand this if you think about how alcoholism is passed down in a family. So if parents drink and their parents drank, then children are either likely to drink or have some kind of reaction to drinking. That's just much harder to work with. Now, how do we link these together with birth and death? Well, coming back around to craving, grasping, say, sticking with alcoholism for a minute, or you could say chocoholism if you want to, chocolate fits better for you, the more you have of that thing that you depend on, that your desire is connected to, your attachment is connected to, the more you become the alcoholic or the shopaholic or the chocoholic. And then you actually have given birth to the identity of that person who is consuming so much chocolate or alcohol. But of course, no organism lasts forever, so eventually this set of desires, forming this wheel of desire, you will die, but you actually, in your own ignorance, pass on the karmic formations towards other people. So this is a Buddhist view of interdependence, seeing that whatever, however you lived through your cycle of desires affects others, and that keeps generating more influence outward. Now, why I explained all that is because it's really a fabulous method for liberation. If you just simply think, well, if I could cut this cycle at any point, it slows the whole process down. It makes it much more difficult to actually keep it revved up. So, you know, the alcoholic quits by not drinking. They just say, I cannot have any contact with alcohol. I cannot even get my sense fields near alcohol. I cannot go into a bar. In fact, I need help. I'll go to AA so that I will manage my feeling states so the craving won't even come up. So by cutting any one of these links, you slow the whole process down. If, say, the family of alcoholics are committed to, I have to stop drinking so I don't pass this on to my children, then you cut the link at another place. So the cycle of desire in Buddhist philosophy is so powerful that it's meant to be engaged in a very big way and with a profound respect for it. It's not that you're flawed if you have desire. It's actually that's what drives us as organisms. The desire for food, for shelter, for water, it's biologically hardwired. You wouldn't exist if desire didn't drive you towards the thing you needed to survive. So I wanted to lay out this Buddhist analysis to show you how complex it is, but also from the beginning to say, I think there's a lot of suffering in consumerism, and it really calls for a kind of strong and committed ethical response based in some well-thought-out philosophy and some serious practices. And there's no time to waste on this, because consumerism's rapidly depleting what remains of our global ecological heritage. So Buddhism certainly does not have all the answers. There's many ways that it's not as strong a religion around environmental concerns as some other religions. But around desire and consumerism, I think it's got a lot of insights. And I personally hope that this kind of information will be very useful to Buddhists and non-Buddhists, and that they'll take up these ethical challenges and use anything from Buddhism that will help have some insight into how we consume. We certainly have the choice to wake up in the midst of this huge planetary suffering, and I'll leave you with the irony that the beauty of the work is that it's so accessible. There's opportunities everywhere you turn with consumerism. Thank you very much. I understand this is a very high-ranking and highly engaged community of scholars, so I really want you to put me to the test. Ask some really good questions here to make this a stimulating evening. Yeah.
From what you said about Buddhism and how it gives suggestions for liberation, mm-hmm. I would assume that would influence the cultures most connected to Buddhism, like India and China. But in the beginning,
Yeah, there's a lot in the world that doesn't really make a lot of sense, isn't there? Well, because if you think about the multi-causal perspective from Buddhism and which causes are having the greatest influence, right now consumerism is, you know, really beating up Buddhism. I mean, in some of the Thai temples, there's competition among monks of who will go to which dinners to get which fatter envelopes of money, you know, when they do their chanting, you know, at the rich people's houses. And there's real debates over monks aren't supposed to carry money, but how about credit cards? or cell phones, maybe that'd be okay. And so it's really, consumerism is so, so all-penetrating. And it's not just that the marketers are evil or something like that. It's that actually a lot of consumer goods make people's lives easier. They really reduce suffering. So if, for example, cell phone technology, you know, has gotten all over Africa way before landlines, and I think that's going to happen in China too, if it enables people to communicate, to stay in touch with families, to figure out how to carry out their businesses, they're going to use it. It's going to reduce some of their suffering. Same with the electric bicycles are very popular in China now too. If that's going to enable them to get from one place to another and not starve, they're definitely going to use it. So what we could use, I would say, is the more of the balance of the religions raising some of the ethical concerns and asking some questions during this runaway kind of economy. And, you know, I don't know how it's going to go, because in China, the middle class is so seductive. I mean, young people there are so thrilled to have a really rich material life. They'll go work in a factory for 4 or 5 years and have a lot of money to spend, and they really want to hang out in bars and get nice clothes, and it's a lot of fun. So I'm not sure that the religious part of the conversation is going to win out on this by any means. It's an extreme irony. And even in this country, You know, we've got a lot of strong religious concern and among Protestants particularly, evangelicals especially, but those evangelical churches, quite a model of consumerism when you go in there. People look pretty good and you go to church there. And, well, they tithe themselves. They want to earn a lot of money so they can give a lot of money to their churches. So it's actually part of a, I think from a Buddhist perspective, you would say, you want to use skillful means in trying to understand these complete conundrums. They're not ever going to be really solved, so you just find a place to work and be within it to find a something interesting to do, I guess. Yeah. Wait, can you talk just a little louder? I can. Right. Yeah, I think you're right, and that part's quite invisible. That's sort of where our big ignorance gap is. We grab the thing that seems to immediately reduce suffering, and we're very short-sighted, very short-term thinking human beings. We're just little animals running around getting what we want and need, you know, not thinking about all these generations to come. It's hard to do, especially in a hyper-individualistic society where you can't even imagine having grandchildren at this age and that they'll have grandchildren. This is not a seventh-generation society. So all that suffering gets displaced, and we don't see it. And some of it's kept deliberately invisible. You don't really want to see those coal mines trucking, trainload after trainload of coal out of Wyoming. But it's getting too big to hide now. It's kind of bursting out in different places, and it can't all be kind of kept under the table. And these concepts of, you know, ecological footprint are getting more and more common. And I think that's one reason the campus sustainability movement's just taking off, because students get this right away. They're so, I mean, so obvious, so quick to learn. So, yeah.
So much of Buddhism is difficult to understand unless you actually have a physical sitting practice. Mm-hmm. You're actually still in your mind. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if these concepts have a chance of really taking hold in people if they don't actually have a meditative practice. What's your take on that?
Well, actually, people in Southeast Asia and other places where they practice Buddhism, I think it's really funny the way Americans just like meditation so much. What is it about Americans? Why do they want to meditate all the time? Because, you know, in Thailand, the Buddhist temple, it's not where people go to meditate. It's where they go to have potlucks and do a little Sunday school and maybe play basketball and meet their neighbors and maybe have, you know, some language study or something like that, or even do some fortune telling. I mean, it's a community center, but it's passing on probably more often good ethical behavior. It's a place to preserve human relations and how to, what you pass on to your children about, this is how we do it, you know, this is how we'll eat together if we're in a Buddhist temple or something. And meditation is seen as, oh, that's something the monastics do. Oh, the monks do that. So it's almost like Americans have taken up the monastic side of Buddhism much less than the ethical imperatives. And I was talking about this at dinner, and Thich Nhat Hanh's often been quite remarked upon this quite a bit. The three treasures in Buddhist practice are the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. And the Buddha is the Buddhist teachings and learning all these principles and philosophy and trying to get them through reading and through meditation. But the other two are equally important. The Dharma is part of the practice of them as you learn and take care of them out. And the Sangha is the community. And if you're practicing all by yourself on your cushion, you can actually get into some pretty big delusions. I haven't seen it yet. It's relatively rare. I'll just say that American Buddhist centers have been able to fully engage all three. They tend to emphasize the meditation. And they're that in that way very different than the ethnic Buddhist centers in this country, which don't do that much meditation. Even the monks don't do that much meditation. So I think a lot of Buddhist philosophy can be gained from a self-reflection and self-awareness and checking one's actions and thinking ethically about what you're doing as a person in the world. Meditation can help that, for sure, but it's not the only way to it.
meditation may give you a deeper taste of some of the more esoteric philosophies, but in terms of just getting along and being a good person in the world, I don't know if it's essential. Speaking as a meditator, yeah.
Could you talk more about the eye, flipping the eye, like tea, or some practical ways of when it comes up, I hate this, I like that, flipping that?
Well, I actually think humor is really good, because if you get to puritanical about this, which, you got to remember those ancestors are all around us here in these gravestones, and they just come right up with their finger pointing, Before you know it, they're there at town meeting, and they weren't even invited. So I think humor really helps to there it goes again. I just need that cup of tea. And then, but sometimes you take the statement, just go back, follow the cycle back a step. Well, what brought it on? Oh, I met with the dean this afternoon. Or something, I'm just making that up, but something that caused you to be in a certain feeling state where you needed something to balance it. So then if you can be with that actual feeling state, you may not actually need the tea itself, or you can have the tea but also be with the feeling state. And trying to be honest, really, I think, with what generated the need in the first place. Because so much of our suffering shows up in these displaced needs. You see it particularly in... I would say around grieving, it's a really easy place to see it, maybe around anger too, but when people have lost someone, that's, we just had a really tragic situation at the UVM campus, and this was really difficult. The woman that died was an environmental studies student, so I was involved. I spoke at the memorial service, and she was in a couple of our classes, and the whole campus was grieving, and it was hard to just be with that. And it was very easy to want to blame the victim or blame the perpetrator and go into these sort of identity-forming things. I have to say, I feel very pleased our president led us in grieving. But grieving is such a powerful emotion. It's so strong that it hurts. I mean, the strong feeling states hurt, and you want to get away from them. They hurt your heart or they hurt your lungs, literally, physically. Your physical body is absorbing those emotions. Or a strong adrenaline state. So sometimes just calming the states down enough to see what's actually going on can be the first step towards understanding the urge. But you have to look for yourself. I know for me personally, it's the cupboard door at night. Is there anything in here? Let's see, a bowl of cereal, a cookie, we just laugh in our household, because my husband's also Buddhist, so it's like, oh, you're at the cupboard door again, are you? Well, what's going on for you tonight? So you can find your own little, what's your own little tips to yourself? And it's very much a self-study. Your own tips won't be the same as somebody else's. So enjoying the study of it and knowing you're not going to get it all figured out in a minute or a year, but you can just say, well, but at least now I'm engaged in studying it and being part of it. Yeah.
This could also be used as a critique against the way consumers are using up all our resources, because if we are, we're actually using up resources, things that have intention,
yeah,
and that have consciousness. So I'm wondering if that sort of critique is dealt with maybe in connection with the Gaia theory.
No, that would be a fabulous article to write, though, the sort of consumption of consciousness. I will say that Buddhist philosophies differ on this. So there isn't one single Buddhist philosophy of nature, and I've gotten into some good arguments about this. The Tibetans are way into animals, are sentient beings, but plants, nothing. I mean, they just don't think plants count for anything, let alone rocks. But Zen, which is the practice that I like, it's like, sure, rocks, clouds, water, everything. I mean, the world is not separatable into those categories from a Zen perspective. It's much more penetrating, but they are culturally a little bit different. But if you did take the Zen perspective, even though, as somebody else pointed out earlier, in Japan we have an incredible consumption of natural resources, so even the Zen perspective hasn't influenced the whole culture. You could take it negatively or positively. If you choose what you're choosing to consume, you could say, I want the consciousness of Dave Zuckerman's strawberries. The way that guy grows strawberries he got rained out this year. I'm already feeling deprived, all that June rains.
I got no strawberries, no strawberry jam, no frozen strawberries. So my life will not be the same. My consciousness this year is deprived of Dave Zuckerman's strawberry consciousness. But you could choose. You could make this your practice. And I think people who do this, I hear about most in terms of kind of interior decoration, a kind of feng shui sort of thing. Look around your house and what things are generating consciousness, are full of life, and where are there dead zones that are actually draining you, like old magazine piles, for example. So you can map your parts of your house, and could you make your whole interior space be life-generating and consciousness-generating? That would be a beautiful challenge. I saw another, yeah.
You mentioned cell phones in Africa and a number of other things that I would maybe count among the genuine pleasures in life, not cell phones necessarily, but
yeah.
I guess it's a mix of pleasures and genuine improvements in quality of life, mm-hmm. in terms of communication or electric bicycles or what have you. I guess my question is whether desire and dissatisfaction actually drive those sorts of changes and are the things that create those things. And if so, why are we trying to break down desire and dissatisfaction if they generate genuine improvements in the human condition?
That's a really good question. I think it's more about living with and understanding the way desire and dissatisfaction work. But yes, dissatisfaction has gotten us out of, you know, old wooden houses that couldn't be heated into, you know, some high R values. This is a good thing that when we get to hit peak oil that we know, you know, what R16 is really going to be better than R3 or something on our houses. So it does. It's a kind of part of being human. I think this is really what you get down to when you practice Buddhism whether you're meditating or doing other practices. You really have to confront that being human is being filled with desire. And part of that desire is what you attach to and form loving relationship with, and it's very painful to be attached, but it's how we live. We have to have human families, to have human relations. But in the midst of it, to be understanding how it happens so that you might guide it, so you could bring some ethical consciousness to it. So, yeah, electric bikes, now that makes sense if you put a few regulations on what kind of the emissions they had and so on. So actually our environmental policy could be a kind of ethical consciousness in the making around go in the direction that reduces suffering across the whole thing, not just displacing it elsewhere. But let the desire drive us towards, wow, solar power. Now that would be a beautiful consciousness to think the sun is heating my house and to unite with solar consciousness. Yeah.
You mentioned solar power. I guess I'm wondering how Buddhism perceives market forces in ethical terms. You mentioned that in China there's an uptake of solar water heating.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it seems that with loss of energy, if oil prices spike, for instance, there would be a lot of market pressure to adopt other sorts of technologies.
Yeah.
I'm curious how it deals with the market as an ethical force.
Terrible. No, really, I wish I could say that, you know, Buddhists were well informed about the economy, but they basically aren't. In fact, when I first wanted to work on a second book, the book before this is a book called Dharma Rain, Sources of Buddhist Environmentalism, and we wanted to just pull together all the good articles that were written by Buddhists trying to think about the environment, because Ken Kraft and I had been reading these and our friends had been reading them, and they were all scattered all over the place. So we did this one collection. Then I was going to do a book on Buddhists commenting on environmental issues. So we'd have a chapter on climate, a chapter on endangered species, a chapter on, you know, water pollution. I quickly realized that I couldn't find any Buddhists that would know about any of those things. There weren't any other Buddhist environmental studies professors. Well, maybe two or something. So I went with consumerism because it's built right into Buddhism, all this stuff about desire and dissatisfaction. So it was easy to find people who could make that bridge and really explicate it. So in terms of the economy and the market, I think Buddhists get just, you know, snaggled like everybody else. Before they know it, they want those shiny new robes. No, I don't know. The market's a very powerful force. And I actually think the monotheistic traditions are much better on this. I mean, for example, Islam has this powerful injunction against usury, the renting out of money, you know. We would not have a capitalist system if we didn't allow usury. If this was an Islamic society that was really practicing Islamic principles, it would change everything. So there's no counterpart like that in Buddhism. Yeah.
I read that the lecture is titled about consumerism, but it was interesting. I found that you were giving a lot of talk of population in the very beginning of the lecture, mm-hmm. and then it sort of dropped off. And at one point, you said population is stabilizing, which I disagree with as I look at trends. But could you sit, if this lecture were about Buddhism and population as opposed to Buddhism and consumerism, could you say a few more words about overpopulation?
Well, let's see. It's good. They're good to go together, definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and in my introductory class, that's how it. You know, there's one lecture on one, and it follows immediately. So you can't really separate them. But it would have been an awfully long evening if I'd done that here. And as far as stabilizing, I just mean it's not shooting off kind of at the rates we'd originally once thought. But it's also not dropping off either. No, it's still growing. There's no question. Buddhism actually could have a lot to say about population, and it's the monastic side of it that's really useful, which reinforces celibacy as an okay path. And I think people that are serious about their Buddhist practice, some people have made choices to not have children so that they can really invest in that, or invest in, say, caring for the planet as a larger family. Buddhism is not, as a religion, pronatalist. The pronatalist impulse and pronatalist philosophy is really much more tied to the monotheistic traditions, which have a family-oriented sort of iconic structure, right? You've got a father and a son, and then you've got sort of the mother with this baby Jesus, and these family things are throughout in Christianity everywhere. But that's not true in Buddhism. That family kind of imagery and aspiration is not part of understanding Buddhist philosophy. So in its fundamental core, it's not pronatalist. It's actually much more encouraging of a monastic lifestyle. The Dalai Lama actually answered a question like this once about just saying, well, a great solution to the population problem is more monasteries. And let people go into the monasteries, have it be respectable, have the local population support their local monasteries just like they support their local organic farmers. A place for ethical training, a place to generate spiritual consciousness back into the society. I think they might be popular, especially, I keep wondering if in my lifetime I'll see green Buddhist centers or green spiritual retreat centers that will be a kind of ecological retreat zone where you can live a lifestyle that causes the least suffering, as we're talking about, and feel good about it and want to just practice that and then teach others and take it out there. We do see, in some Western countries, population levels dropping off. Actually, in the United States, our population is just going up, up, up. There's been a lot of articles lately because we hit the 300 million mark. And that I don't have a handle on. I think Buddhists in this country won't make much of a dent. There's too few of us. But overall, as a philosophy, it doesn't take a position. But this the monastic contribution is huge. In some southern countries, it's quite normal for a young man to go and spend 3 months, 6 months, a year in a monastery. And it's a great place to tame that testosterone. You know, just like slow things down a little bit here. Make some wise choices. So that could be, you know, philosophically a way to go with it. But there's nothing really right literally in the... So all the way in the back. Okay, we'll come back to you. How about that?
I was wondering if you could talk about the commodification of Buddhism. I was in Japan over the summer, and I found that the level of commercialization at Japanese temples was astounding.
It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah, it's shocking. You know, compared to some of the sterility, relatively speaking, of our churches in this country, the baubles that are sold, it's all fundraising. It's all money-making, you know. Buy a little prayer flag, and, you know, it's all ways to support the temples. So... actually, I sought out young authors, at least two young authors for this book, because I wanted to get a feeling of how consumerism works within actually religion. And so one of the authors, Sumi Laundon, wrote about how consumerism has actually brought young people to Buddhism in this country.
And she compares notes with people in Korea and Japan. And it's just all, sort of all part of that culture. Get your mala beads, you know, or go to see the Buddhist movies. We've all seen them. Or go to the Buddhist rock band concerts. So it would seem like, well, how can this work? But because that is our world, our world is full of this stuff, everything is an entry point too. So it's kind of what you sort of make of it, how much meaning you invest in it. But I think those Japanese temples, it could be very interesting to do unlearning consumerism workshops, you know, with the monks at some of those temples and say, have you thought about what it is you're, you know, selling and how you're doing it and why? Because I think it's just kind of an automatic, and it looks like it's cheapening to us. But if it brings people in, I don't know, it's very very contradictory.
Do you mind if I ask another question?
Yeah.
Do you think that, you know, that sort of a corruption of Buddhism compromises its chances of, you know, like a taming consumption? If that makes sense.
Well, yes, if you're a puritanical idealist and you want to, you know, shoot holes in anything else, because, you know, everything has problems in a certain way, and the idealist only wants the sort of black and white world, so to speak, and the Buddhist is, you know, actually has to get pretty comfortable with the contradictions because they're all exist internally. Nobody has worked them all out to be only pure in one direction. So I think Buddhists in a certain sense may be a little bit better suited than some of the Christian traditions that really hold up these pastors or ministers as the icons and so on. I mean, if you're higher up, you have further to fall. And so I think the Buddhists maybe sometimes keep a little more grounded. Even the Dalai Lama will always start off with, I'm just a humble monk and I just practice kindness. And so that helps. I don't know how many more we should go.
I was just going to suggest that for those people who do need to leave, Stephanie is kind of offered to stick around for a while. So if any folks who would like to stay and ask a few more questions, just give people an opportunity to leave.
Okay, I'm happy to keep going. I'll keep talking here as long as people want to, and I can come down or people can stay. I'll kind of leave it. Shall I just come down? Okay. That's where you want to stop, right? Okay.
Sorry you got in your way.
No, at least I didn't break it, you know?
Okay. Thank you.